Let's begin, Satish.
Yes.
It's a great pleasure and a privilege to be talking to you. I have been following your work since Resurgence in the early days. And recently, I became a pilgrim. And when I became a pilgrim, I found out how difficult it is to actually walk your talk. Because as you know, when you're a pilgrim, it's not the physical difficulties that you face when you're walking. It's the mental difficulties and the moral difficulties of issues that arise within you that you haven't taken care of. In my own experience, what I discovered was that unresolved issues in my life were actually manifesting in the environment around me at astonishingly high rates of coincidence, which of course refers to the idea of synchronicity. Why wouldn't that happen in my normal life? Why would it happen more when I'm alone as a pilgrim? Is the first thing that I would like to discuss with you, because it seems to me that there's a different modus operandi when you're a pilgrim and you've decided to go on a spiritual journey rather than our everyday materialistic journeys. You've done a lot of pilgrimage. Does what I say make sense to you in terms of you categorically saw a difference when you were in pure pilgrim mode, walking, and in your ordinary life? Was there a difference for you, or had you trained long enough that it didn't really manifest that?
For me, life itself is a pilgrimage.
Yes.
And I became a pilgrim at an early age.
How old were you when you began?
I was, I think, 4.
4? You started pilgrimages at 4?
Because my mother was a pilgrim.
I see.
And she used to take me to her farm. And she will always walk to the farm. And she said that walking to the farm is a pilgrimage.
Ah, wonderful.
And she said that if we go on horseback, then we are just interested in getting to the farm.
Mm.
But when we are walking, every step we take is a step of completion, step of fulfillment, step of self-realization.
Your mother is telling you this when you're 4?
When I was 4.
Well, you really had a wonderful mother.
Absolutely.
Incredible.
She was a truly spiritual being and a pilgrim.
Mm.
And so, mother would say that when you touch the earth, you are touching a sacred space. It's a divine space. And God is present in the earth.
Mm.
And everything upon this earth is a manifestation of the divine spirit in physical form. Every physical form has an invisible dimension. And that invisible dimension is the divine dimension, the spiritual dimension, the dimension of imagination. You have to imagine that this flower is not just a physical flower. It has divine spirit in it. And that can only come with the power of imagination.
Mm.
And that was teaching I got from my mother from age 4 and 5.
Oh, this is a very important point, Satish, imagination, because the way that the word is used currently is severely limited to the idea of artistic imagination, of writing or of painting, of creating. The true purpose of imagination, according to Thomas Aquinas, for example, in the Western tradition, was exactly what you're describing, was so that we could actually visualize the impossible to visualize, which is the invisible, untouchable, unreachable, ungettable. However, by using the powers of our imagination, we can get closer to the divine presence, Therefore, we should use our imaginations in such a way.
Yeah.
But you were given a mother who taught you this from four. You're part of probably 0.0001% of all humans who have ever lived came in with a very big lucky break.
That's right.
A very lucky break.
My mother's teaching was that the physical form is a vehicle to carry the invisible reality. Now, for example, words. Words are only a vehicle to carry the meaning. Mm. So the body is only a vehicle to carry the love. If you have no body, then how do you embrace somebody? How do you look at somebody? How do you kiss somebody? So body is a vehicle to carry that compassion, that generosity, that love.
Mm-hmm.
So in the same way, the flower is carrying something. Flower has a physical form, but it will also have an invisible dimension. And that invisible dimension can only be realized through imagination.
Uh-huh.
Because only the third eye, which is the eye of the imagination, the two eyes are the physical eyes, can see the physical form. But in order to see the non-physical form, the invisible reality, you have to have another dimension in yourself. And that another dimension, metaphorically, is spoken of as the third eye. Mm. And what is the third eye? The third eye is the eye of the heart, the eye of imagination, the eye of the spirit. So imagination, from a spiritual point of view, from an Indian perspective, is much bigger than just artistic or poetic imagination.
Right.
Of course, that's a part of it, because through art and through poetry, you can reach the divine. William Blake and his imagination was reaching the divine.
And so was Tagore, of course, reaching the divine.
Exactly. The Tagore was reaching through his poetry, through his music, through his paintings, but he was reaching that invisible reality of the divine. And the divine word, sometimes we are a little bit sort of confused and we don't know what it means. The divine simply means the eternal reality of blissfulness. Eternal reality. And which is implicit every moment, in everything, here and now. Divine is not in the next life. Divine is not in the book. Divine is not in the church. Divine is not in any kind of exterior reality. It's interior reality. It's present every moment, in everything, in every second of the time, in every word we speak, every atom we touch, the divine presence is there. But what is lacking is imagination.
Mm-hmm.
Without imagination, we cannot experience it. And in order to experience divine, you have to imagine that there is bigger reality in that flower, in that tree, in that river, in that butterfly, in that human being, in that bell, in that sound, in everything, that two dimensions, the visible dimension, the invisible dimension. And the invisible dimension is the divine dimension.
It's a very important point. You're talking about two dimensions, the visible dimension and the invisible dimension, but you're not talking about duality as far as I can feel. You're talking about a unity of two dimensions at all time. They're not separate. They're not different dimensions. They're coexisting. Imminent dimensions, I believe is what you're saying, as opposed to the ancient Western idea, the Gnostic idea, that there is a real world, a physical world, but it's not as real as you think it is. It's like a matrix, like in the movie. But there's a separate spiritual world above and beyond that, that is almost untouchable and unconnectable, and therefore we are in a prison here. We're far from heaven. We have been cut off. This is an idea that seemed to have some possibilities, However, what you are describing now is not duality.
It is not duality.
It is not duality.
No.
It is the coexistence of two dimensions.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not duality because the spirit and the matter are two aspects of one single existence. Without spirit, matter cannot exist.
Yes.
And without matter, spirit cannot manifest itself. So matter needs spirit, and spirit needs matter. Without each other, there is no existence. So it's a completely one single, complete whole, purnam in Sanskrit, complete and whole reality. But in order to understand it, in order to make sense of it in our language, in our intellect, in our communication, we sometimes explain it. So this is only a way of explaining that it's a visible reality, this is an invisible reality. But they are one and the same. There is no separation.
Yes, yes. However, in current 21st century reality, how many of us actually have the ability, well, we all have the ability to use our imaginations to appreciate the divine presence in every moment, because we're all born the same. We all have bodies. We all have brains. However, the great tragedy, especially of modern times, I think, I don't know too much about if this happened in historical times, if we completely lost our imagination before. But it seems to me we have utterly and completely lost our divine imagination almost totally today, resulting in the manifestation around us that you've been such a great campaigner for, of a return to a more spiritual, ecological outlook that is not limited to any one perspective. Let me get back to your mother, because the problem is we don't have the imagination now. I see that as a challenge, as a problem. We've lost that imagination. You were gifted with a mother who taught you that imagination. Perhaps you can let us know how she taught you in more practical terms, on a day-to-day basis, how she brought you to the idea of being a pilgrim, and how you related back to her your experiences and how that helped you to grow. Because I think you had a unique upbringing.
Yes. I was very fortunate to have a mother who was extremely wise, and she saw nature as the divine manifestation. Mm. So in practical terms, she taught me to connect with nature, of rediscover, always rediscover our connection with nature, because we are nature, and therefore we are related to everything around us. So she will, when we will walk, she will always give examples. She will always point out, as a child, I will see that what is going on, and she will point out. So, for example, honeybee. My mother will point out that look at the honeybee. Honeybee can teach us the lessons of transformation. Mm. Now, that's a divine dimension, which you can only learn through imagination. Mm-hmm. The honeybee is doing a physical reality, physical action, but there is an invisible reality of transformation. Mm. Now, honeybee goes from flower to flower, collecting nectar here and there, little here, little there, never too much. And once it has collected the nectar, it transforms. It transforms nectar into sweet, delicious, healthy honey. Mm. That's a divine dimension. Now, also honeybee is a pollinator. Mm. Honeybee is the key to our existence.
That's right.
If there's no honeybee, there's no pollination. If there's no pollination, there are no plants.
Yeah.
If there are no plants, there's no food. Yeah. If there's no food, there's no life. Mm. So how, in an extremely simple way, my mother taught me to be a pilgrim of nature and a pilgrim of the divine at the same time. Mm. And by connecting with nature, we realize that how everything is completely and intricately and kind of in a subtle way, totally interdependent.
Yes.
Life will not exist if there was no honeybee. That's one example. Mm. This was in a kind of a practical way my mother taught me to be a pilgrim. Mm. And walking was one of the most beautiful way, because when you are walking, you have time. You are going slowly. And when you are going slowly, then you are looking around. If you're on a horseback, or worse of all, in a car, or a train, or even worse of all, in an aeroplane. So you see nothing. You don't connect. You are disconnected. But when you are walking, you are connected with the earth, you are connected with the air, you are connected with the trees, you are connected with the sunshine, you are connected with flowers, you are connected with fungi, you are connected with birds, you are connected with the entire universe. You are one. There's no dualism there, but completely one. And these were the kind of simple, practical examples that my mother would give me to teach me to be a pilgrim.
Where did she get her wisdom from?
I mean, the traditional society of India was very, very connected with the spirit, with the soul, and with the earth. So people lived, so my mother's ancestors were in the same way. They lived close to the land, and they derived their life from the land, from nature, from the ecosystem, from the biosphere. And so they were connected. They did not live in these high-rise buildings or air-conditioned houses or air-conditioned cars or whatever, compartments which we build around us. So my mother's wisdom was there, passed on, oral tradition mostly, oral culture, passed on from generation to generation to generation. That was a true education, true teaching. My mother was illiterate. She could not read.
Really?
She could not write.
Huh.
She could not even put her signature.
Really?
If there were the legal papers to be done, then she will do a thumb with ink. So she was illiterate in kind of conventional terms, but she was educated.
Totally
educated. Mm. Illiterate, but educated.
Mm.
And even more so, wise, because she was a very conscious being, because she was connected. She was not disconnected.
Mm.
Our problem in modern world is all the science and technology and buildings and roads and vehicles and mobility and so on has brought us a disconnection.
Mm. It has brought us a huge disconnection. And at breakfast today, we touched on that. How is it that what you say makes total sense to any, I believe, to any open-minded, sane human being? How can you dispute what you have said? Well, a materialist will dispute it by saying there is no proof for the invisible realm, but that lacks credibility in a modern world where we're finding, even through science, for example, Rupert Sheldrake, I was in the airport, has just come out with a book about the sense of being stared at.
Mm.
And he, as you know very well, is the creator of the idea of morphogenetic fields, which are invisible fields.
Mm.
Invisible, that's the point. Invisible fields of what? Invisible fields of information.
Mm.
And so even in science, we are being shown by pioneering individuals that it's all obviously true.
Hmm.
So how come, when it's all so obviously true and so simple and so beautiful, that even an illiterate woman in India has completely got it in her daily life, how is it that 6.5 billion people have pretty much forgotten it?
Yeah.
This
yeah.
is the question that I think we should take a direct look at. Why?
Yeah.
How?
We have forgotten because we have become dualistic and one-dimensional.
And one-dimensional, very good.
Yeah. One-dimensional in the sense that there's only one way to know. Whereas in Indian tradition, we say there are many ways of knowing. There's no one way. One way of knowing is to measure, to quantify, to touch, sensual way, you can know. But there is another way of knowing, and that's intuitive way.
Mm.
There's another way of knowing, and that is emotional and a kind of spiritual way, psychological way, relational way. So if you are in agreement with the idea there are many ways of knowing, and if we have many ways of knowing, our knowledge will be more comprehensive. So you will know by measuring, you will know by feeling, you will know by loving, you will know by doing, you will know by making, you will know by experiencing, you will know in many, many different ways. And that knowing is more complete. At the moment, our intellectual knowing is very limited because we only know if we can measure it, if we can quantify it, if we can analyze it, if we can replicate it. That's a one way, and it's nothing wrong with that way as long as we do not discard all other ways, subtle ways of knowing. So traditional societies of Aboriginal people, of American Indians, of Bushmen in Africa, the Hindus in India, the Taoists, the Shintos, all traditional societies had many ways of knowing, and therefore their knowledge was much more comprehensive, much more complete, and they were able to connect themselves with the universe. Because every human being, or every flower, or every animal, or every bird is a microcosm of macrocosm. So how you, like William Blake said, that how can you have the eternity in a moment, and a kind of whole universe in a grain of sand or a seed. So this microcosm of macrocosm, so human beings are microcosm of macrocosm. Everything in the universe is in human being. The universe is made of earth, air, fire, water, space, time, consciousness, intelligence. All these elements are in the universe. Human beings have all those elements in a miniature form, in a kind of microcosm. So in that microcosm, if we can realize that, then we can become the universe. That's a kind of self-realization that a Buddha or a Jesus Christ or a Lao Tzu can achieve. They can become the universe by realizing that they are the universe. And this dimension of knowledge is missing because scientific knowledge, and because scientific knowledge has become so powerful, they are using their methodology in schools, in universities, in all the research departments. So everybody's being educated, because not being educated, not going to school, is a sign of backwardness or underdevelopment. So the sign of development has become that you must go to school, you must become literate. And the teaching in schools and universities is only one dimensional, which is literal and measured and kind of quantified. So we are all in a way brainwashed throughout the world, everywhere. There's only one methodology is being taught. Whether it's India now, modern India, modern Japan, modern Europe, modern America, modern Australia. Modernity has brought this one-dimensional education. So we are all conditioned and brainwashed into thinking only in a quantitative and a materialistic term. So if we want an ecological, sustainable, and a kind of more spiritual and more fulfilling and more joyful and more happy, self-realized life, then we have to expand our ways of knowledge. And we have to be more inclusive and not say there's only one right way, and that's a scientific way. All other ways are wrong way. That's a kind of a scientific fundamentalism,
yes,
which is prevalent,
yeah,
in all our education. So we have to be free of that scientific fundamentalism and say scientific way is one way, which is a useful way, it's a good way, there's nothing wrong with it, but there are other ways, and other ways are intuitive, other ways are experiential, other ways are caring, loving, compassion, consciousness, spirituality. All those ways are ways of knowing and making sense of the world. And this is what we need to bring back. And I think we can bring back.
Well, I applaud your optimism, Satish. However, you've just said that we are all brainwashed.
Yeah.
Now, when you have the idea of brainwashing or conditioning, you must also include the idea of brainwasher and conditioner somewhere in that equation. This is why I want to hone in on this discussion as to how we got into this impossibly precarious position where, as you said, for everybody to live like the people around us here in Devon, with a car, with their house, with the three meals a day, with the electricity, with the refrigerator, with their insurance policies, we require at least 3 to 4 Earths to accomplish this for every human being on Earth. That is not going to happen. We're not going to get 4 or 5 new Earths.
No.
And it is also not going to happen, in my view, in the near future, that all the people living around here with their refrigerators and their cars and their lifestyles and who believe in science and progress and democracy and freedom, they're not going to suddenly give this up because of some, for them, amorphous theory of everything being interconnected. This is the challenge that we face.
But the challenge is also the consequence of the lifestyle that we lead today.
Of course.
All the things you listed, cars and computers and aeroplanes and insurance and all these things, they have a consequence. There is no such thing as an action or a lifestyle without consequence. So the consequence of this lifestyle is to be realized. And the consequence of this lifestyle is tremendous stress on individual life, tremendous pressure, tremendous strain, tremendous psychological upheaval, tremendous pressure on family life, tremendous pressure on relationships. And therefore, if you have cars and computers and televisions and all the other paraphernalia, but no happiness, no relationship, no friendly friendship, no family, then that consequence will be realized and felt. So at this moment, many, many people are realizing that I have everything and I'm not happy. So how can I create a new life which is simple but elegant? An elegant simplicity where relationship is at the core of my lifestyle. Friendship is at the core of my lifestyle. So without the backbone, you cannot have your body. You need flesh. You need sort of nerve system. You need all the other sort of parts of your body. Like you need hair and you need everything. But if there is no backbone, body will not stand. It will fall apart. So what is the backbone of human life? The backbone of human life is good relationship. Good relationship with yourself. Good relationship with your fellow human beings, whether it's your beloved person of your life, or your children, or your mother, your father, your neighbors, your friends, and a good relationship with the land, with the animals, with the trees, and the beauty of the place where you. So only through relationship that you can find that sense of fulfillment and joy and happiness. And that consequence of materialistic, acquisitive, consumerist lifestyle that we have, the consequence is gross unhappiness. And that gross unhappiness is a personal price that we are paying. On the other hand, there's a social price we are paying. When you have cities like Tokyo and Hong Kong and New York, you also have slums. So on the one hand, you have a very unfair kind of architectural system where people can live in very luxurious apartments and Empire State Building or whatever great buildings there are. But the consequence of that is a large number of people have to live in slums because all the resources are sucked away into small places. So that's a consequence. Then we are using all this fossil fuel to run our energy system, our our industry, our shopping, our food distribution, production, clothing, shoes, furniture, computers, television, everything we are making is based on one source of energy, and that's fossil fuel. The consequence of that is global warming. So if people start to look at the consequences of the lifestyle which we have built in the last 200 years or 300 years, then we will realize that this is not a happy consequence. And therefore, we need to redesign the world. And redesigning the world requires a new consciousness. Mm. And that new consciousness is based in imagination mm-hmm. and based in spirituality. Mm. So when people realize that, then I think we can redesign the world in a way which is elegant, which is comfortable, which is beautiful, which is joyful, which is happy. And as you said, we don't need three or four or five planets. We can live on one planet happily. If there is enough in the world for everybody's need, but not enough for anybody's greed. Mm. So we have to redesign the world on the basis of need and relationships rather than greed and fragmentation.
Mm. That is obviously what has to be done. I get back to this idea. In India, in Aboriginal cultures, in North America, the Plains Indians, in South America, the shamanic cultures of the Amazon, the Bushmen of the Kalahari, all of these wonderful and fast disappearing tribal cultures. And this is what Wade Davis, the anthropologist, is focusing on, and he will also be part of our Earth Pilgrim series. His mission is to rescue their knowledge before they're completely and utterly
gone,
cultures at the edge. And everything he says makes total sense. Everything you say makes total sense. But I'm coming back to this really nitty-gritty integral question of how on earth we got so far off course. And I've come up with a rather difficult to accept conclusion after 30 years of trying to figure out how we got so silly. You've talked about consequences. The consequences should be obvious to any intelligent human being. Everybody's educated. Everybody knows about emissions. They know about the disparity between the rich and the poor. But still they don't realize. Still it doesn't come to a real feeling within them. There's a bifurcation, a separation that is almost fatal. And when I track it back to when I think this really started, which was, of course, the Industrial Revolution, I think anybody would agree that that was the wave that began what we're in here. Who was behind the Industrial Revolution? My country was behind the Industrial Revolution. Scotland was behind the Industrial Revolution. The Caucasian, the white man, was behind the Industrial Revolution. I'm not talking about racism here. I'm talking about perhaps there is some kind of strange genetic inherent fault line within the structure of the Caucasian people. Because it is the Caucasian people, in my point of view, who were behind all of this phenomenal scientific development, this tremendous rational power to logically power their way through all of the natural resistance people would have had, and have taken it to this incredible level that it's at now, with no sign of stopping, no sign really of stopping, that I can see, apart from the best efforts of people like yourself, the so-called opposition is gigantic. And so is it possible, within your philosophy, within your ideology, is it possible to accept the fact that there's a kind of a virus has been unleashed upon this earth, a very strange virus, which I believe has a lot to do with my culture, with white people? Is this a concept that you can even think about? Because I'm looking for the sources of evil myself in this equation.
I would say that the source of our crisis, and it is not evil and good conflict. Good and evil go through every human heart.
Yes.
It is not confined to a particular culture,
Absolutely.
Or country,
yeah.
Or color, or race, it goes through every human heart. Mm. Now, what we need to do is to see where it begins in our hearts. Mm. It begins when we are beginning to start ourselves as separate individuals, atomized, autonomous. I am not you. I am not the tree. I am not the animals. I am separate. This separational worldview, which has been there in many, many cultures, of course, the Western societies have perfected it.
Yeah, well, that's my question, Sadi. Is it really in all these other cultures? Really? Is it in the Aboriginal?
I think so.
Is it in the
not Aboriginal, but in India you had many, many. I mean, Ravana's culture of Ravana.
What was the culture of Ravana?
The culture of Ravana was to conquer.
Oh, I see.
To conquer nature. Oh. So that's a kind of. So I would not put a kind of evil as
not blame the Western, all the white guys, you know?
White guys as evil guys. I would not say, but the Western industrial system had perfected it.
Yeah,
and they have been very industrious themselves in exporting this idea to the rest of the world. Mm. So now India, China, Japan, all these cultures have sort of somehow embraced
Infected, I would say.
Yeah, absolutely. So, but the root cause is in our minds.
Yes. Yeah.
In our minds, in human mind. And every human mind has these two things. Like a field has brambles and poisonous plants and fruit and flowers and soft plants. Everything is there. The universe is made of this kind of yin-yang forces. Mm. And Eastern cultures in the ancient times cultivated the positive spirit. Mm. They cultivated the non-dualistic spirit. They cultivated the flowers, the bluebells, the primroses, the roses, the fragrant flowers. They discouraged, even though they knew that you cannot completely get rid of the brambles and the kind of poisonous plants, but reduce them, keep them under check, don't water them, don't cultivate them, don't encourage them. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the kind of more modern industrial mindset, we have confused and we have thought that the poisonous plants are the flowers. Mm. And the flowers are just a kind of superfluous decoration. You don't need them. So this kind of confusion. So we have watered the seeds of anger, the seeds of control, the seeds of ego, the seeds of pride, the seeds of greed, the seeds of privilege. All these things have been watered, cultivated, and kind of encouraged. And that begins in the kind of idea of individualism. Mm-hmm. The Indian and Chinese and traditional Japanese, Shinto, Aboriginal cultures, American Indian cultures, they did not have the idea of a separate individual. Mm-hmm. Individual word means indivisible, meaning you cannot separate, you cannot distinguish, indivisible. So we are all part of the one picture. But the meaning is changed. And now individual means separate being. And that individuality, individualism, separate from relational philosophy. And I mean, Descartes' idea of I think, therefore I am, cogito ergo sum, is an expression of that individualism and the egotistical thinking. So I would not blame any one culture. I think now, if India and China were so pure and so wonderful, why are they embracing this industrial mindset? And why Africans are embracing? Why? So the seeds are always everywhere. And because those seeds have been watered and cultivated and encouraged, so they are now taking over the world. Now our challenge of the pilgrims is to bring, to water the seeds of pilgrimage. Water the seeds of unity. Water the seeds of relatedness, that we are all one. And therefore, if rainforests are being cut down, my hair are being cut down. If the trees are being destroyed, my arms are being destroyed. If the rivers are being polluted, my blood veins and blood streams in my body are being polluted. So when we start to reconnect again, only connect, if that was the renewal and the renaissance, the only connect, then I think we can recover. So the origin is in the dualism.
Mm.
The origin, wherever it is, whether it's in China or India or Japan or Africa or Europe, the origin is in the idea of dualism, separation, fragmentation, individualism. Now we need to go back to relatedness. In India, we always said that all beings are our kith and kin. Vasudhaiva kutumbakam, in Sanskrit, we say Vasudhaiva kutumbakam. The whole earth is one family. Earth is a community. And there is a wonderful theologian in the United States called Thomas Berry. And he says the universe is not a collection of objects. It's a communion of subjects. Now, he is a Christian theologian coming from the United States. And he got it.
Non-dualistic. Even he got it.
Even he got it. Non-dualistic worldview, where he says the universe is a communion of subjects and not a collection of objects. So that is the attitude of the pilgrim. The pilgrim sees the sacred and divine present everywhere. God is not beyond the sky somewhere sitting. Heaven is not beyond the sky. You don't have to look up to find heaven. Heaven is here on earth. The God is here present in the butterfly and in the worms and in the grass and the flowers and the river and the drop of water in the river. Present there is divine. So the moment we can switch back, and this industrial revolution is only 200 to 300 years old. So this is a kind of a small moment in the geological span of time. There's nothing. So it will pass. It will pass. Because the idea of the pilgrim and the pilgrimage is that let this pass. And then let's go to the eternal truth. And the eternal truth is that the earth is a divine gift, the divine presence, and we can transform our lives, and we can, and by transforming our lives, we can transform our consciousness, and by transforming our consciousness, because consciousness is one universal, the whole universe can change back to a more balanced dance of Shiva. The universe is a dance of Shiva. The moment we realize that dance, we can transform the world. So I would say that blame is not on one race or one country or one color or one community. The struggle of good and bad, I wouldn't call it evil, because evil to me does not exist. For me, there is a good and there is a bad, and that sometimes bad can be good and good can be bad as well. So even that dualism does not really stand. It's all mixed together. And everything has a place in its appropriate place. Even a bit of anger has a place in its appropriate measure. But like in food, you have a little salt and a little chili, but you put only a pinch of salt and a pinch of chili, and that makes good taste. If it was no salt and no chili and no oil, and you just had cauliflower or cabbage, it would be not so delicious. So even a little bit of anger is divine. Even a little bit of ego is divine. But we have to understand what is the proportion. Everything has to be in right proportion, and the right time, in the right place, and the right measure. And that consciousness is the overriding consciousness. When you are, your consciousness is in driving seat. When your consciousness is in charge of your ego and your anger, then you can control it. You can keep it in right place, in right time, in the right measure, in right amount, in the right proportion. And that skillfulness is the challenge of our time.
There is some kind of a dichotomy. Mm. It's not just a Western idea here. Mm. The brain-centered form of existence and the heart-centered form of existence are actually very, very different. Mm. And obviously your mother wasn't using her brain to write and to read and to capture the world in the boxes of the intellect. She was working with her heart. She was feeling the environment through her heart. Some people believe that the heart is where the soul resides. Mm. And even physiologically speaking, we have found that the heart itself as a physical organ has cells in it which are almost exact copies of a certain type of brain cell which records memory. Mm. And we've discovered that the heart has its own memory system, its own power system, which is electrical. It has its own way of appreciating the universe that is similar but more deep than the head system, which is why the Egyptians, when they created their mummies, always put the heart back into the mummy. They threw away the brain, the intestines, the liver, the kidneys, but they made absolutely sure that the heart would go back in, because maybe later on that memory of the soul could be accessed through rebirth. Mm. These days, we're discovering through heart transplants that you actually take on the soul characteristic of the previous recipient. Many cases of men behaving more like women, of white people behaving more like black people because the other recipient was a different race. Mm. But most importantly, discovering that there are deeper dimensions to a human that go way beyond the brain, which we now call the Almighty, represented as the computer in our civilization. Mm. Your mother was obviously the former. She was based in the heart. Mm. I think Indian culture is, of course, it has the tendencies of the mind also, but the heart is the key to our discussion here. You were at a very early age brought into the world of the heart through your mother. She walked you to the fields. How long did it take for you to walk to the fields?
The farm, the field, small holding, was about 3 miles.
Oh.
So it will take just over an hour. And we will go in the morning, and the field mother has very purposely bought towards the west of the village, west of our house. So when we go in the morning from our house, the sun is in the east, is on our back.
It's behind you. Yeah.
Behind. That's the wisdom.
Oh, and, interesting.
And then when we are coming back in the evening home from the farm, then the sun is again on the back, setting in the west. Mm. So we will walk to the farm in the morning and come back in the evening. It will take over an hour. And my mother and I would always walk slowly because she would always try to sort of enjoy a slow walk in nature. This was a good, healthy thing. My mother always say that when you are walking, you get perspired. And perspiration is good. This way, you are shedding the poisonous sort of things from your body. So your body is becoming clean by sweating. Mm. So if you have not walked or not sweated, then you have not done your day's healthy exercise. So for your health, she will ask, have you sweated today? So that was mother's very common sense. Mm. You can say peasant wisdom, not a kind of Vedic, kind of intellectual, learned wisdom. It was more a wisdom. She learned her wisdom through mythology, through stories, through singing, through meditation, through walking, and mainly observing nature, being in nature, because we are one with nature, because we are nature. I mean, interestingly, the English word nature is very interesting, because the word nature come from the same as natal, native, nation, and all those words relate to birth.
To birth.
Yeah. So natal, nativity, is related to birth. So when a mother goes to midwife before the birth, it's a prenatal check. Yeah. And then after the birth, postnatal check. Mm. When you say, I'm a native of India, meaning I was born in India. India. So that way, and the Jesus nativity is a Christmas nativity time, because Natal in South Africa is because the Englishman went there on Christmas Day and discovered their city, so he called it Natal.
Oh, I didn't know
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah. So that's a Natal city in South Africa. So very interesting that the word nature in English is related to birth. And therefore, everything, whatever be born and will decay, is nature. So human beings are born, human beings will die and decay, our bodies will decay. So we are part of nature. So my mother's attitude of that unity of life, manifesting in millions and millions of forms, that was her eco-intelligence, nature intelligence. She understood the workings of nature in an intuitive way. This is what I would say. The way of not knowing for her was more intuitive than a kind of analytical or scientific. It's more intuitive. So we'll take 3 hours walking and then do the work on the farm and growing vegetables and the crops is a transformative experience, because you are sowing the seed. If you plant the seed, that seed is going to become the tree. That's the power of transformation. It's not force. Force you talked about, and power. Force is violence. Power is non-violence. So power of non-violence and force of violence, those are the difference between force and power. So the power of the seed is a power of transformation. You plant a seed. Now, if you take the banyan seed is the smallest of the small seed that you can imagine.
No, I didn't know that.
So small,
oh, really?
That if you put it on your hand, you may not see it. If you don't have a good eyesight. Or it's very, very, it's smaller than the mustard seed. It's a very, very tiny. You have to have a magnifying glass to see it. And a teacher asks you in India, break that seed. Hardly you can break it, but break it. And you break it. What do you see? I see nothing. But in that seed is the mighty banyan tree, which is the biggest tree. The biggest tree in India. It can have 1,000 branches.
Oh.
And if you go to see the 1,000 branch banyan tree in the Botanical Garden of Calcutta, you will not know which is the original trunk. So huge. It's almost like a cathedral, like a huge temple. It's like a great building. So that seed you plant in the soil. Now what happens? That seed goes in the soil and will never return again. That particular one, never return again. Because it's gone, it's dead. But it's not dead. It's alive, but we think it's gone. It goes in the dark soil. It's in relationship. It's like making love. It's in relationship with the earth, with the water, and with the sunshine. And remains there. And then suddenly a small plant comes out. And that small plant becomes a large tree. And the large tree has branches, has leaves, has fruit. And again, that seed which died is reincarnated into the seed again. And that one seed has given birth to thousands of new seeds. That's a reincarnation. Thousands of new seeds are coming back. So this kind of observation of nature, and not only observation intellectually, but emotionally and spiritually connecting with nature, relating with nature, feeling one with nature, the unity of life, when you see it, you realize the relationship. This is what we have lost in our modern world. This is what we have lost in our educational system. You are PhD, but you don't know a leek from wheat. You are PhD, but you don't know the process of the seed. What's the good of being PhD? So what we need to do is to reconnect with our process, that the cycle of life, there is no end. It's a cycle. The beginning and end are part of a cycle. So the seed dying in the ground is giving birth to the tree. So death is valuable. Mm. Death is important. Death is as good as life. Mm.
That is sacrifice.
Death is as good as birth.
Yeah. Yeah.
Dying is as good as living. Mm. The moment we realize, then we see the cycle, cyclical way of life. At the moment, our thing is linear. Mm. We think you are born, you live, you die. Therefore, we are afraid of death because we think that's the end. Linear thinking, that's the end. But death is not the end of life. Death is the door into new life. The moment you realize that, that's what I learned from my mother. My mother never afraid of death. Yeah. Because when she was 80, she said, now I must embrace death. So she went to all her family, her daughters and daughter-in-laws and the sons and the grandchildren and all her friends and said, goodbye. From tomorrow, I'm going to fast unto death.
Oh, that's right. I remember in No Destination.
Yeah. And she fasted for 35 days.
Yeah, to death, yeah.
To death. Because she was not afraid of death. Mm. She embraced death. Mm. Because death is a door into new life. So my mother's wisdom was to connect with nature in that way. And by connecting with nature and the power of nature, the power of transformation, you transform yourself. Because you are nature. Nature and you are not separate.
Your mother was permitted to do that in those days. That would have been 1960s?
Actually 70s.
1970s.
Yeah.
In those days, you were still... You can't do that today. Fast.
You can.
You
can
still do
that. Yeah.
In India, the government permits people to.
Yeah. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
That's astonishing.
That's the old Jain tradition, also Hindu tradition. My teacher, my guru, Vinoba Bhave, he was a great Gandhian saint. Mm. I have been very fortunate to have a mother like my mother.
Yes, indeed.
And a guru like Vinoba.
Oh, yes.
Now, Vinoba, when he was 75 or in his mid-70s, he took ill and he developed a very bad, severe case of ulcer in his stomach. Mm. And so he was taken to hospital and the doctors said, we have to make a big operation and remove the ulcer from your stomach. And so you have to sign that if something goes wrong, we are not responsible. So Vinoba said, is that really that serious, that big operation? And doctor said, yes, it's a very big operation. So Vinoba said, I'm in my mid-70s. There's no need for me to live and go through all this operation and so on. So please don't do it. So he did not sign it. Let me go back home. So he came home. And when he came home, on the way back from hospital to home, he made a decision. He said, when he goes home, he's not going to eat. He's going to fast unto death. Mm-hmm. And he also fasted unto death. And during that week of his fast, 30,000 people visited him.
My God.
And Prime Minister of India, Mrs. Gandhi at that time, she visited him.
Oh.
So fasting unto death is a noble, sacred tradition in India. Mm. And you cannot stop people from fasting to death. It's not suicide. Mm. Mm. It's embracing death. It's not suicide. Mm. It is a love of life. And love of life includes love of death. Mm. So it's not a kind of way that the Western modern scientific thinking about death, that we think of death. Death is a part of the cycle of life. Like seed going into the soil, we go into the soil so that a new birth can happen.
Absolutely. That was a very impressive story about your mother, but I didn't realize that the same thing happened to your guru.
Yeah.
So he had a week of fasting before he died?
A week of fasting before he died.
I see. Were you present at that time?
No, I was not present there, but many of my friends were present there.
Mm.
And when he died, his funeral procession, there were 50,000 people. And this gave all those people who loved him opportunity to visit him, come and say goodbye to him, sing songs, sing hymns, and do prayers, do chanting. And through chanting, he was enchanted and re-enchanted.
Mm.
And so his death was a re-enchantment of life.
Mm. It's a wonderful celebration of life to die in such a fashion.
Absolutely. That's the true word, celebration.
Which is very difficult for us, and we're presently in the United Kingdom, and such ideas are completely heretical.
Yes,
where and we will hang on to life until the very, very end. So
I think in the modern medicine and modern kind of therapy, we are too afraid of death, and we try to prolong life by this, that, or the other means, and technological means, medical means. And it's unnecessary because we need not fear death. I have said to my family that if I have any serious illness, heart attack or any serious illness, please do not take me to the hospital.
Oh.
Please do not call ambulance. Please do not call a doctor.
Mm.
Let me die. Mm. There's nothing wrong in dying.
Mm.
We all will die. So let's die with happily. Let's die with happy. What is going to happen anyway? Mm. Why allow it to happen with sadness and sorrow and a kind of denial and a kind of hate? I hate death. No, death is good. So love life, love death. Both are equal. Two sides of the same coin. No dualism. And like the matter and spirit, there's no dualism. Death and life, there's no dualism. It's a unity of life, which includes death.
Well, that's that reminds me of Dogen Zenji, who was the founder of the Sodo sect of Zen Buddhism in the 13th century. And somebody asked him, what is the Buddha? What is the Buddha? And he said, the Buddha is life and death.
Yeah.
That's a beautiful, simple
Absolutely.
Answer. The Buddha is not just life. The Buddha is life and death.
Yeah.
Buddha consciousness equals the consciousness of life and death.
Yeah.
But your mother was a real live example of that. It's one thing to talk about that sitting here in the beautiful English countryside.
Yeah.
But when you actually get the heart attack, you actually get the feeling, oh, it's time up.
Yeah.
And you have the nobility of soul to go and say, I'm going to just not eat until I die, because what's the point?
Yeah.
The only other place I've heard about that are, for example, the Buddhist saint Kukai. He fasted until death. Certain other Buddhist saints I know did do that, and their bodies are very remarkably preserved because of that. But your mother was obviously a great influence. I'm getting back to the pilgrim. You would walk with her. You would get
and
this
that
incredible
was pilgrimage. That was
every
a
day.
Pilgrimage. So this is why I say I started to become a pilgrim or learn to be a pilgrim. And the attitude of pilgrim is that all conditions, all situations, all encounters are there as a learning opportunity. There are no encounters, no hardships, no difficulties to be avoided or discarded or be afraid of. All opportunities, negative or positive, comfortable or uncomfortable, present themselves as an opportunity for self-realization, opportunity for learning, an opportunity for self-purification, an opportunity for the strengthening of the soul, the strengthening of the spirit, because only through rough and difficulties and hardships that you develop your character.
Mm.
When something has weathered, in English language, we say it has a character.
Mm.
This building you are sitting in has
indeed.
A character
because
it has weathered.
Mm.
It has gone through snow, wind, storms, rains, sunshine, every kind of weather. And the building says, every weather is my opportunity.
Mm.
I'm not going to say, I only like sunshine and not snowstorm. Every weather is a good weather. And therefore, this building has a character. So in the same way, in human life, what I learned is that everything happens, good or bad, what we think good or bad. You don't know what is good and what is bad for you. Intellectually, you think it's good or bad, but in other ways, it might be very good for you. What appears to be bad.
Now I'm beginning to get the flow here. Okay, I'm beginning to get the flow of what you're saying, because this directly relates back to your incurable optimism about the future of humanity.
Yeah.
Perhaps this situation that we're in now, which from any logical perspective is hopeless, is impossible.
Yeah.
There is no way that China is going to stop emitting CO2. Yeah. There's no way America is going to. We know this is not going to happen unless there's the Virgin Mary or somebody appears. Yeah. So where does your incurable optimism come from? I'm getting it. It's from the pilgrim spirit. Even this, we know it will pass, but even this has something to teach us.
Yes.
Even the destruction of civilization, the collapse of the ecosphere, the disappearance of the bees has something to teach us a fundamental value, and therefore we should embrace it, we should accept it. Of course, we do our best to transform it. Of course we do.
Transcend our best. And transform.
Yes,
because what we can learn is that our desire to control, and this is what it boils down to, we have a desire to control. And we think we can control nature, we can control people, we can control events, we can control our future, we can control other people, we can control our destiny. And this desire to control and the idea that we can do it is a kind of arrogance and ego. And what we can learn is that we cannot control. We have learned it. In spite of all the realistic leaders of the world, all the kind of clever scientists of the world, all the kind of entrepreneurs of spirit and entrepreneurs of the world, where are we? We are in a situation where we don't know anything. We don't know anything. We don't know how to solve the problem of war. We don't know how to solve the problem of poverty. We don't know how to solve the problem of hunger and deprivation. We don't know how to solve the problem of ecological environmental destruction. We don't know how to solve the problem of energy. We don't know anything. And we say we are very clever, but we don't know. For 100 years, we have been trying to eliminate poverty out of this world, and it's increasing. For 100 years, United Nations for 60 years had been trying to keep peace in the world, and there are more wars in the world. So what we can learn is that we cannot control destiny. So why are you trying it? Just we can participate in the process of the universe. We are the participants, not in charge, not the bosses, not the kind of people being in control, and we are the driving seat, and the nature is there for us to use and abuse. We are the masters. We are the superior race. This arrogance, this idea of control, we can learn from our experience that we cannot control. Nobody can control. And if there's no control, then just participate joyfully, blissfully, happily. And when you participate, you create an elegant lifestyle for yourself and a relationship-based lifestyle. And that is the lesson of our time that we can learn from this negative situation. And we can also develop that only way is not control, but love. Love of the earth, love of the rivers, love of the forests, love of the trees, love of life, love of animals, love of birds, love of each other, love is the real power, and the control is the force. And I think power versus force.
Well, actually, it brings us to Gandhi. And what you've just described is actually perhaps a very useful new definition of humility.
Yeah.
Humility is a very difficult word in English, I think, for people to grasp. They kind of feel that it means like Uriah Heep in Dickens novels, that creeping away in the shadows has no self-value, no self-worth. No. That's not humility.
No.
Humility is an extremely powerful
humility state. Is not timidity.
Yes, it is not timidity.
Yeah.
It's an extremely powerful state of mind.
Yeah.
which in the New Testament, for example, the word meek is used. Mm. But the original meaning of the word meek is not timidity at all.
No, it's a humility.
It's humility.
Yeah, humility.
Which means to understand that you actually do not know anything. You do not have any control over anything.
Yeah.
And once you get that clear, was a big
relax.
I can relax.
Just enjoy.
I'm not going to get enlightened.
Yeah.
You know, the purpose of meditation. We were meditating here this morning. It was wonderful. But I think when everybody starts to meditate, the first idea that comes into the head is, I'm going to get enlightened doing this.
Yeah, yeah.
And there has to come a certain point where they just get humble enough to go, what, me get enlightened? No, that's not going to happen. I'm just going to actually be here and enjoy it. So humility is very powerful. And of course, the great symbol of humility in the 20th century, I believe, was Gandhi. Because he was a man, went to meet the British leaders dressed in a dhoti.
Yeah.
And who takes on the whole British Empire.
Yeah.
Which is not an empire of power. It is an empire of force.
Yeah.
Because it's an empire that requires billions of dollars and armaments and security and soldiers and policemen and politicians to keep it all working. And this little guy in his dhoti, you know, with some of his teeth missing, he completely overwhelms them.
Yeah.
And the reason I bring this up is because in power versus force, you can calibrate the level of consciousness of historical individuals.
Mm.
Gandhi calibrated at an astonishing 740.
Mm.
The British Empire at the time of Gandhi calibrated at 145.
Really?
Which means it was under 200, which means it was total force.
Yeah.
And which meant it had no real power.
Yeah.
Which helps us to understand how one guy can do that.
Yeah, yeah.
And it brings us to the next idea of numbers.
Mm.
You talk of transformation. It's a word that many people use as if it was relatively easy for anybody to transform themselves. It's not, because they have to be humble.
Mm.
Transformation won't happen without humility.
Yeah.
And humility won't happen without understanding and appreciation that we have no control.
Yeah.
So certain things have to be in place for people to be able to transform themselves.
Yeah.
Does now everybody have to transform?
Yeah. Just to pick up on your word power and force. Power is from inside.
Yes.
From within. And therefore you can be empowered by realizing of your own inner power. Force is imposed from outside.
Mm.
So Gandhi's power was power of the soul, the spiritual power, the soul power, and not a power of the gun and the police and the military and the paraphernalia and the money and the position and the status and the office. All those things. These are external. And what is from outside given to you is force. But what is inside you? So the seed has power to become a tree because it's inside it.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't come from outside.
That's right.
There is a story of, we'll come back to Gandhi, but the story of the Buddha and the Angulimala. Angulimala, I've written this into a book called The Buddha and the Terrorist. Now, Angulimala is wanting power. But he's not really wanting power. He wants force.
He wants force.
Yeah. But he thinks there's a power. So he said, I want power. I want to get hold of the state. I want to control the government. I want to be the king. And the Buddha meets him. And when Buddha is coming towards him, Angulimala says, you fool, why are you coming here? Don't you know who I am? Buddha says, yes, Angulimala, I know who you are. You are Angulimala. So Angulimala says, yes, I am Angulimala, which means I am going to kill you without blinking an eye. Buddha says, yes, Angulimala, I know you are Angulimala. You can kill me without blinking an eye. But do you know who I am? I am the Buddha who can die without blinking an eye.
Yeah.
That's the inner power.
Yeah.
He can. The power of killing is a force because you are imposing. Mm. But the power of being ready to die is the power of inside. And so Buddha says to Angulimala that I was a prince. I would have been a king. I could have invaded others and become an emperor. But I thought that was futile. That's not power. That's only force. The real power is inside. And so I am in search of inner power, the real power, the true power, which is power and not force. And so Buddha was powerful, became powerful, and after 2,600 years later, we remember the Buddha more fondly and admiringly and a kind of with pleasure than hundreds and hundreds or thousands and thousands
emperors and kings
have come and gone.
Yeah.
They had force, but not power. So same is example with Gandhi. Why Gandhi, half-naked fakir, Churchill called him. And
Churchill called him a half-naked fakir?
That's right.
Cheeky guy.
Half-naked fakir. And when he came to London for the negotiation, he went to Buckingham Palace to meet the king. And when he came out of the Buckingham Palace, there were lots of journalists there. And the one journalist from the Times of London, he said, Mr. Gandhi, you went in this loincloth to meet the king? Is that a kind of right protocol? How did you feel going to meet the king in Buckingham Palace in your loincloth? So Gandhi said, the king was wearing enough clothes for both of us. So that was his humility. But the humility was inner power. So he did not care. He did not have to have a tie and a suit and a hat and umbrella to go and see the king in Buckingham Palace. He could go in his loincloth because he was a man of power and humility inside himself. So the real power, and that is only power, and the power is inside. When something is coming from inside out, that's the power coming out. When you are forcing something from above and from outside in, that's a force. And so spirituality is power of humility. Spirituality is power of the spirit, the inner power. And then force is more physical. Force is more material. Force is more in the laws and the regulations and the office and the money and the police and the military and the gun and the nuclear weapons and all the kind of money power. That's force. So that's a very good distinction between power and force.
It's a very good distinction because he took it further. The level of energy of an individual who is at 1,000, which is Buddha, is so colossal because it's logarithmic. That if there is one Buddha on the world and the entire human population is below 200, which is force, that is still enough to keep everything in relative harmony. Because a very high level consciousness individual, and we've just seen it was real. Gandhi really did transform. One little guy in his dhoti. And it had nothing to do with his brain power.
No.
It had everything to do with humility and his high consciousness. So,
Humility and integrity.
Integrity
between his words and his actions.
Yes.
He always, when people came to him, people said, Mr. Gandhi, please give us a message. What is your message? We have a conference. Please give us a message. What is your message? And Gandhi said, I have no message to give. My life is my message. Once one of the Indian leader called Dr. Lohia, L-O-H-I-A, Lohia, Dr. Lohia went to Gandhi and said, Mr. Gandhi, we have many, many great orators in our Congress party. We have many, many great intellectuals and writers like Nehru, like Patel, like many, many others. But they don't have influence on people. When you give a call, hundreds of thousands of people follow your call. And they go and march, and they go and fast, and they go and spin the spinning wheel, and they go and get arrested and fill the jails when you give them a call. But when we speak, we give a good oratory, but nobody listens. What is the magic? What is the trick? What is the key? Why you are so powerful? Gandhi said, I don't know, but only one thing I can tell you, that I have not asked anyone to do anything mm-hmm. which I have not done myself mm-hmm. and tried in my own life. Mm-hmm. So I did not. So that's integrity. His words, his actions, his life were one whole, integral whole, integrity. Once a woman, it's a story, a woman asked Gandhi with her son that, Mr. Gandhi, my son eats too much sweets, sugar. Please tell him that's bad for his teeth. He won't listen to me, his mother. But you, saintly Gandhi, if you tell him, he will listen to you. Gandhi was a bit reluctant. He fell silent. He did not say anything. Then he said, dear mother, come back in fortnight. Then I'll speak to your son. So she went. And Gandhi waited for 2 weeks. And then the woman came back with her son and said, you said to me, come after 2 weeks. My son is still eating too much sweet and won't listen to me. Please somehow convince him that it's too bad for his teeth. And so Gandhi said to the son that, you know, sweet, too much sweet, not only not good for your teeth, but not good for your whole body, for your life. Too much artificial, quick energy. So, after a while, the mother asked Gandhi, Mr. Gandhi, why did you wait 2 weeks to tell my son like this? You could have said the same message 2 weeks ago. Gandhi said, Mother, at that time, I was eating sugar. Everything. So I could not say to your son, which I was not practicing myself. Yeah. That is integrity. Yeah. That is integrity. Yeah. Once Gandhi was staying with the Indian leader called Jawaharlal Nehru, Mr. Nehru, in his house. And in those days, there was no running water, no tap water. So in the morning, you bring a jug of water and with a bowl to wash your face, wash your teeth, wash your hands, the morning wash. And so Mr. Nehru brought the jug, because Gandhi was his guest in his house, so he'd look after the guest. So as a good host, he brought the jug of water, the bowl, so for your morning wash. And as Mr. Gandhi was washing his face and Mr. Nehru was pouring water, they were talking. They were talking about politics of India, the independence of India, the British, how to get rid of them, how to organize the movement, all those wonderful philosophical and political things. They were talking, busy. And jug water finished. So Mr. Nehru said to Gandhi that, please wait a minute, I go and fetch another jug of water. So Gandhi said, what? Another jug of water? Have I finished whole of that jug full of water without finishing my hands and face and teeth washing? So Nehru could not understand. He was puzzled. Why are you so worried about jug of water? He said, don't worry, Gandhi. I get more water because there's no shortage of water in my town. There are three great rivers, Ganga, Jamuna, Saraswati, three great rivers flowing through my city. There's no problem. You are not in your Gujarat, which is the run of Kutch, which is the kind of desert land. Mm-hmm. You are not in the desert of Gujarat. You are in the fertile land of Allahabad, the northern India. Gandhi was in tears. He said, Mr. Nehru, you may have three rivers flowing through your city, but my share in those three rivers is only one jug of water. I have been very wasteful. I've used too much water. Whether I'm in desert or in your fertile land, I should take only little water. If that's why Mahatma Gandhi said, there's enough in the world for everybody's need
but not enough
for anybody's greed.
Yeah.
And that is Gandhi. So Gandhi's humility and Gandhi's power came from his life, the integrity, and a kind of, he lived what he taught, walked his talk. And that's why Gandhi is such a great inspiration to me. When we say oikos, which means home, what does home mean? Home means not just the brick and mortar. Home does not mean just the building. It's not a house, it's a home. Home means relationships. When you say, I'm going home, means I'm going to a place where I have relations. My father, my mother, my daughter, my son, my wife, my whatever husband, whoever your relations are there, that's a home. So home means a place of relationships.
Mm.
So earth home, oikos is the earth home.
Mm.
And so earth home, earth community is the place of relationship. So everything is related. And that we have to learn, that everything is related. And out of the relationship, you create the management. So ecology should come before economy. And if not before, at least ecology and economy should go together, like walking on two legs.
Mm.
If you walk on one leg, just economy, you will be limping.
Mm.
So at the moment, our society, our civilization, our world is limping, because we have no understanding of ecology. And therefore, we are creating economy in such a way which is causing mess, causing global warming, causing climate change, causing world hunger, world poverty, all the and a kind of psychological distress and unhappiness. That is because we have disconnected economy from ecology. So the purpose of Shimaka College is to establish a place where all knowledge can be studied and learned in a holistic way, in an interconnected way. So studying together, but also not just studying intellectually, but studying intellectually, emotionally, spiritually, and physically. So learning and living must go together. And that's kind of balance that we create in our educational system. So when people come here, they participate in meditation in the morning, they participate in the cooking, they participate in the gardening, and they also have a classroom where they have intellectual lectures on science, on economy, on ecology, on world issues of every kind. But it is not just intellectual, it's experience, it's a community. Like in the olden days, we used to have monastery. This is not a monastery, but it's an ecostery.
Mm-hmm.
So monastery used to have a bit of set of rules and too many regulations and too much control and too much sort of dogma. You have to do this and you can't break this rule. But here it's a free spirit. You just ecostery is a community living. There are not too many rules, not too many regulations. People have a free spirit. They come here to rejuvenate their spirit, to renew themselves, to learn, to experience, and then they can go back home and they can learn, and they can live, and they can practice, and they can create examples. And here we have courses which last 1 week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks or 1 year. And if you do a course for 1 year, then you can even get a university degree, a master's degree in science.
Oh, really? Oh.
So you can do a MSc, master's in holistic science. So this way, it's a small college, but experimental college. And we would like to see the whole of educational world transforming and changing in such a way that education becomes responsive to the world situation. At the moment, in our education, there's too much of brainwashing going on, where people are just sort of educated to think that if we have a good degree, they will get a good job, they will earn good money, and that's it. But we say that the purpose of education is not only to earn a good living or earn good money, but the purpose of education is to serve the earth and serve people and serve the relationships. And making a living is only a small part of it. Mm. And also making a living, earning a living, is not just a kind of money-making thing. It should also be involved in making things. So you need to learn physical skills like gardening, cooking, building, making pottery, making woodwork, making things. Because through making, you can transform matter into something like nectar into honey.
Yeah.
The honey
yeah.
bee does. Yeah. You can transform a piece of clay into a beautiful pot, and it becomes a beautiful pottery, work of art, but also useful. You can take a piece of wood and you can transform it into a sculpture or a chair or a house, a tea house. And that way you are going through process of transformation. So when you transform a piece of clay into a beautiful piece of pottery, you have experienced transformation. And you have gone through the fire of transformation. And when you have gone through the fire of transformation, you are transformed.
Mm-hmm.
Now you are no longer just anyone. You are a potter. You have been transformed into a great potter. In England, we had a potter called Bernard Leach.
Yes.
He's transformed. The clay transformed him
mm-hmm.
as he transformed the clay. In Japan, there was a great potter called Hamada. Now, Hamada transformed clay into a beautiful pot, but that beautiful pot and that clay transformed Hamada into a great artist mm-hmm. and a great potter.
Mm-hmm.
So this experience of transformation can only happen when you are engaged with your hands and with your eyes and with your imagination to make something. In our modern industrial mindset, we are thinking that making anything is backward, underdeveloped. Only the poor people make things. Crafts thing is poor people. I will go into banking. I'll go into finance. I'll go into insurance. I'll go into work in a big office or government office or business office or retail office, whatever. And that's a kind of mindset which we need to question.
Mm.
And we need to examine, is that the kind of mindset which will bring you a sense of fulfillment, a sense of creativity? Because if creativity is not there, how do you use your imagination without creativity? So imagination and creativity are the twins. They need each other. At the moment, we are missing out on imagination because we are missing out on creativity. And creativity means arts, crafts, building, gardening, cooking, farming, everything becomes a part of that creative imagination. And when you bring imagination and creativity into your daily life, everyday activity, it becomes meditation and it becomes a spiritual practice. So for me, gardening is a spiritual practice. Cooking is a spiritual practice. Any work I do is a spiritual practice because it is driven by the power of imagination and manifested in the power of creativity. And when imagination and creativity are at play and when they are useful as well, then they become spiritual practice. My mother used to say that everything you do should have three dimensions, three aspects. Whatever you make should be beautiful.
Mm.
Beauty is essential. Beauty is the food for the soul. Soul is nourished and nurtured only when you are surrounded by beauty.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's a flowers or good pots or good house or good clothing or good food, beauty must be part of it. But just beauty as a decoration is not good. Beauty must be integrated with utility. So everything you make should be beautiful, but at the same time should be useful. If it's not useful and it's just beauty for decoration, as a kind of like something on the wall, then it's not good. And then it should also be durable.
Mm.
So whatever you make should be beautiful, useful, but it should be lasting. Make something to last, not just use today and throw it tomorrow. Garbage, the waste. Waste is the sin against nature. Mm. Because how will you like if I waste your time? Mm. You don't like me to waste your time. You don't want me to waste anything of yours. So, but we take things from nature and waste it and create garbage and put in the landfill. How nature would like it? So waste, in my mother's view, which I learned, and from Gandhi's perspective, and from Vinoba's perspective, and from ecological perspective, and holistic perspective, waste is a sin against nature. Mm. We should not do anything which is wasteful. Mm. So durable. So I have translated my mother's teachings of beautiful, useful, durable in what I call the bud principle. Mm. B-U-D, mm. bud. Mm. B, beautiful. U, useful. D, durable. Mm. B-U-D, bud. Mm. Bud is the unfolding flower.
Yeah, the unfolding.
So unfolding flower. So this is the beautiful teachings which I learned from my mother. And this is the kind of education that we are bringing here at Sri Mahal College, so that there can be a place. It's no good just saying educational system is bad, the universities are bad, and all this is no good. That's not enough. We have to set an example. It's better to light a candle than curse the darkness. Exactly. Yeah. No good in just criticizing and blaming and condemning other systems. Unless you take your energy and your creativity and your imagination and your effort and your time and create a new something, set an example. So that's the kind of walking your talk is the kind of Gandhi's idea. So Sri Mahal College is established in order to create an example of learning, where learning and living, creativity and imagination, spirituality and practicality, science and spirituality go together. And science and spirituality go together, very important, because without spirituality, science can end up in all sorts of bad technology. Mm-hmm. It can become a victim of the exploitation if it has no spirituality. So you end up creating nuclear weapons. Nuclear weapons are created by the scientists and the technological people because they have no spiritual guideline. Mm. Or you end up GMO, genetically modified organism, and the agriculture, monoculture, and the factory farms, and wasteful production system. So science must be guided by spirituality. If it is not guided by spirituality, then it will end up in the wrong hands. But at the same time, spirituality should be guided by science. If there's no science, there's no rational thinking, there's no intellectual thinking, there's no understanding of things as they are, we end up in dogmatism, fundamentalism. Like this Christian fundamentalism or Hindu fundamentalism or Islamic fundamentalism or any kind of fundamentalism is a result of a kind of blind faith, blind thinking. So spirituality needs science. Science needs spirituality. We can have best of both worlds if we combine those two together and marry science with spirituality. This is the kind of marriage that we create at Sri Mahal College. Sri Mahal College teaches holistic science. We give, you can have a master's degree here in holistic science because it's science and spirituality, science and art, science and daily life. It's integrated. And that is the kind of thing that is needed. And I think lots and lots of people are coming here from all over the world, even people from Japan coming here to study. And then now we are hoping that many, many more people will make new colleges like Sri Mahal College in different countries, so that while the old system is dying, the new system will be born. And we have to be midwives to that new system. There's no point in being pessimist and say, oh, what can we do? Everything is going bad. Everything is going bad. Everything is not going bad. These things are dying. Mm. The old system is dying. So do not worry. Do not moan about it. Celebrate the death of the old system. Mm. If it's collapsing, let it collapse. Mm. If it is dying, let it die. Our job is to be midwife of the new system and create new kind of agriculture, new kind of craftsmanship, new kind of education, new kind of schools and universities, so that when this old exploitative, wasteful, materialistic, dualistic paradigm comes to an end and dies, we are not left at sea without any direction. So we need to work at this moment to create new examples.
In Japanese, the same word is used for imagination and creativity.
Yeah.
In Japanese, it's sozo.
Okay.
So when you say, when the verb to imagine and the verb to create are the same verb in Japanese, sozo suru.
Okay.
And sometimes people do a check with each other. Are you talking about the imagination or the creativity?
I see.
And we thus understand how language is intimately connected to your paradigm. The Japanese have always known that imagination leads to creativity, and you can't have creativity without imagination at a very, very fundamental level.
Yeah.
I look forward to a chapter of Schumacher actually emerging in Japan. As you said, you've had some Japanese people here. I do believe it's possible to create a chapter over there. I do believe that it's required and it's needed, especially in Japan. You mentioned waste. Japan is probably the number one perpetrator of waste on the planet. It is gigantic amounts of waste. I would often comment going to shops where they would wrap your purchase 3 to 4 times and then put it in a plastic bag. And I would say to them, no, you don't have to do that. And they would look at me as if to say, but how can you possibly take this home only wrapped in one? Meaning that there was no concept of waste. There was no understanding of where that was going next to on the production line to the garbage fill that they're going to build their houses on top of. In other words, bifurcation, disconnectedness lead people to think certain things are normal when they're not. So we get back to education. And again, I return to Japan because that's where I feel that the educational system is seriously, seriously failing the people. Where we have young children committing suicide, literally, because they don't pass examinations. Where there's tremendous violence against children in the school system. And where the parents feel helpless to offer them anything else, because there is nothing on the horizon. At least there is Schumacher College in the United Kingdom. At least there are certain open schools in the United Kingdom. You pioneered the idea of small school, which we're going to go into more detail tomorrow. But unfortunately in Japan, these are just concepts right now. When you went to Japan last year, what did you talk to people about and how did they respond? What kind of questions did they have for you?
No, you are absolutely right that in Japan, the idea of over-packaging has really taken hold.
Really?
And people are over-packaging. And I talked a lot about this waste and over-packaging in Japan. And I said, you can just package things in an old way, where they had a piece of cloth.
That's right. Furoshiki. Furoshiki.
Furoshiki. Yeah. And you piece of cloth, you put it in, and then you take it out. You can wash the cloth. You can put it nicely back. And then when you are giving present next time to next buddy, you can wrap it again. That's a kind of durable, beautiful, useful way of packaging.
Yes.
Why don't you go back to that rather than this plastic and paper? And if you look in nature, there is no waste in nature. And nature has a wonderful system of packaging. If you look at orange, the segments of orange are separately packaged in the round. And it's bound by little strings in between.
Yeah.
So they're held together. Then after that, there is another packaging outside. And then you take that outside and put it on the compost. And that will become food for the worms and for the soil. So you can nourish the soil with that packaging. So in everything in nature, there's a beautiful system of packaging. If you take a cauliflower, it has flour to eat, but almost more than the flour or same amount of greenery around it to protect the flower. And when you want to eat, you take the greenery away and you put it in your soup to make a stock, or you could put it in the compost. But nowadays in Japan, what people do, they put that orange peel or the cauliflower green into a plastic bag. Mm. And what do they do with plastic bag? Put it in a bin. And what the bin happens, one day a week, a lorry will come and take that bin to a landfill. It's a sin against nature that you are taking the nutrition, which is the peel, which is the cauliflower greens, which are compost, which is nutrition to replenish the soil, to nourish the soil, to nurture the worms, to feed the soil. And you are putting that into landfill where it will create greenhouse gases. And we call ourselves intelligent, educated people. My mother was uneducated or unliterate, never go to school or university, but she knew better. She make everything into compost and return back to the soil. So this idea of recycling, reusing, returning back to the soil, nourishing the soil, replenishing the soil, this is what I talk to Japanese people. I said, in Japan, you had that wisdom before the war, Second World War, but you are losing it out. You think that was backward. The progress is to waste, and the underdevelopment is to reuse and recycle. So this is what I talk to them, and they were interested. They would say, we never thought of it. In our schools, we think we are never educated in these sort of ideas, and we don't have mothers who teach us like that. So I think we need to bring this simple common sense to people in Japan and in England and everywhere.
Yeah, well, the key word to your entire philosophy is simplicity. The idea that it doesn't have to be difficult, that everybody can do it in their daily lives, that everybody can apply it. I like the bud. The three, again, we have three concepts here. Yeah. We'll be getting into the other three concepts later, but the idea is these three should be in everything: beautiful, useful, and the durability issue was brought up recently. I don't know if you've seen it at Schumacher. The story of stuff has been going around the planet. It is a wonderful 30-minute cartoon story. You haven't seen
it? I've heard of it, yeah.
The story of stuff is brilliantly done. A woman spent 10 years at it. And what she does is she stands in front of a screen where cartoons flow. Mm. And the story of stuff tells people very educationally, where did it come from? Who was involved in the creation of it? Who carried it over here to sell it to these people? And who were the ones who made these products non-durable? So that these people over here would throw them away here and buy new ones. Mm. And how did it all actually begin? Mm. And she really researched the story of stuff. Mm. And she said that just after the war, some leading politicians for the American, leading advisors of the American government said, there is only one way we will survive into the future. And that is to create an endless consumer culture that never, ever finishes. And that will employ these people over here and these people over here, and these people will buy it. However, the woman who told the story of stuff said, what's not in that equation is that these people over here who are being paid 2 cents an hour to produce the raw materials that up here will be made into a thing that will be sold over here, are having their lands polluted, their health destroyed, the social systems bifurcated, all negatives. Mm. We don't have them in our stuff picture at all.
Yeah.
And the result is that we've got blinders on. Now, yeah. I know at Schumacher here, you have a map up on the wall about where your products come from.
Yeah.
Who creates them and how they are created. Yeah. And this kind of flowchart is just missing in the educational system. Mm. It's not in the picture whatsoever. Yeah, yeah. So presumably, what you're doing here is an adventurous pilot idea that hopefully will light up in other parts of the world. Yeah. Have you actually got any other parts of the world that are taking on your programs?
There is one in India.
Oh, there is in India.
And somebody called Vandana Shiva.
Oh, I've heard of her.
Yeah.
Yes.
She has started Schumacher College, kind of college in India, where she is teaching people the same thing, how to go organically, how to save seeds, how to recycle, and science and spirituality integrated, art and culture integrated, and living simple but elegant and satisfactory and a beautiful and a joyful and a fun life, not a drab life. The ecological lifestyle is not a drab life. Mm-hmm. It's a full of art and crafts and imagination and creativity and culture and celebration and music and dance without waste. Mm. So this is a kind of college in India called Bija, B-I-J-A, Bija. And Bija means seed.
Ah, I see.
It's a college of the seed, seed college or school of the seed. So Bija is the Indian thing. And at this moment, we have got here a course going called Certificate in Education. And these people will come for 5 times a year, 1 week each time. And in between time, they will be studying and stay in touch with us. And so a year-long program. And after this program, we are hoping that some of these people will start new colleges like Schumacher College in their own areas and their own places.
Oh, so you're creating the seeds as we speak. How long has this educational program been going on?
This is the first week.
Oh, perfect. It's
you
perfect.
Are the pioneer, witnessing the pioneering course.
Wonderful.
The first week starting, a new course have started. And one Japanese person is attending.
Well, isn't that coincidental?
Yeah.
So this one Japanese seed will no doubt go back and at the very least talk about it, but who knows, might actually create another Schumacher College over there.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's a perfect time for us to wrap up for the morning because you've covered the educational aspect before we actually go into your lecture.
Yeah.
And we'll return to the theme of pilgrims later on today, but I think we've covered enough at this point.
Okay.
The last part of your discussion impressed me very much because what you said about an elegant, simple, beautiful, exciting, creative, colorful, healthy, wonderful lifestyle is not what comes to many people's minds when they think of ecology. They think of, we're going to be limited. It's going to be a drag. We're not going to have designer goods, you know, to entertain us. Whereas you're saying it's the exact opposite.
Just exact opposite.
Exact opposite. It's much more fun.
Yeah, much more fun because at the moment, our busy, busy life, very stressful, commuting from suburbia to the city, working in the offices, has taken out this celebration of life and celebration and joy of life. People in industrial societies, in Japan, in the United States, in Europe, and in big cities like Mumbai and Calcutta and Delhi and Mexico City, people have no time. They are time poor, time starved, time hungry. Whereas in my mother's time, she used to say, when God made time, he made plenty of it. Why are you hurrying? What is the hurry?
Oh.
Yeah. So she was time rich and she had a lot of celebration and beautiful things she made by hand. So having fresh, healthy, delicious, organic food from your garden is the greatest luxury that people are missing out when they get wrapped up food in plastic, imported from somewhere, Kenya or somewhere, and they pick things like apples or oranges or bananas, unripe, and then they ripen it in artificial conditions. There's no taste, there's no celebration, there's no creativity. So we are being sold a system which is glamorous and glittering and pompous and has a kind of show, external show, but lacks the quality. The real quality of life is missing. And therefore, the ecological life and the ecological vision of a new society and a new lifestyle, a new world, is a vision of joy and quality. Higher quality of food, higher quality of clothes, higher quality of houses. Not too much, but better. At the moment, our industrial system is based on consumerism and a mass production. So it's always fostering on us too much, more, more, more. Ecological vision is not more, but better. better. Less is more. Less but better. Have less food but delicious food. Have a few clothes but beautifully made clothes. Have a small house but beautifully comfortable house, handcrafted. Mm. And we want to say also in this ecological vision that work is not a drudgery.
Mm.
Work is worship. Work is dignified. We want to restore the dignity of work. So when Hamada making pots is not a drudgery, Bernard Leach making a pot is not a drudgery, it's a joy and pleasure. Somebody building a beautiful house, like a tea house, it's not a drudgery, it's a beautiful expression of your imagination, your creativity, your skillfulness. And so in an ecological new worldview, restoring the dignity of work and saying that making things by hand is not drudgery, it's not backwardness, it's not underdeveloped, it's not the poor who have to work and rich have to just sit and enjoy Coca-Cola. That's not the vision of ecological society. We want to say everybody should have opportunity to express themselves through their work, but work should become artwork, work of art. So anything you do, gardening or building a house or making clothes or making pots or making chairs, they should all be products of art and crafts and beauty and sustainability and durability. And that's the vision of joy and fun and pleasure. So I want the spiritual lifestyle, an ecological lifestyle full of sensuality and full of relationship and full of love and joy. That's my vision.
Oh, I like that vision. We'll communicate this vision to the Japanese. It's so much more infectious than the ideas. The ideas of, let's call them pseudo-gurus,
yeah,
who bring a new mantra in and tell them that it's all going to be all right. It's not very cohesive at all. Thank you, sir.
Okay.
We'll end it there for this morning. And
you're welcome.
You are done, yeah? That was good. Wonderful.
Okay.
Thank you, sir.
You're welcome.